The following is our conversation with Gabriel Ferman, CEO of BuroWorks. We talk about their approach to innovation at BuroWorks, as well as their participation in the Product Innovation Challenge at LogWorld 51. Enjoy.
That's a good question. My background is actually pretty weird. I studied philosophy and psychology and linguistics and particularly the philosophy of language in college. My degree was actually called The Death and Rebirth of Human Agency. It was about how the awareness of linguistic structures allows people to feel more or less in control over their own actions. So it was actually pretty cool. I actually had a concentration in interpretation theory. So I was really focused around language and the production of meaning. I never thought I was going to use that again because I got tired of academic studies, went into the business world, got fired very quickly, became a translator because I grew up speaking Portuguese, English, and Spanish. Then I learned a little bit of French, Chinese, and Italian. So I loved languages. I began translating, and that went well. I built up a translation agency. I pivoted that into a tech-enabled business, and then began building software in 2015. And since 2023, we're a fully software company. And yeah, that's my journey. You know, it's interesting. The Process Innovation Challenge, in my opinion, is a great stage and a great way to showcase innovation. I think the challenge is that even though I knew the context existed, I don't think we had truly been able to embrace innovation as a company-wide thing until 2023. And I think the reason is, you know, innovation, I mean, in my opinion, above and foremost, is a matter of mindset and a matter of people. And I think it doesn't happen if you just have, let's say, sure, you could innovate if you just have a few engineers doing R&D in the lab. But I think the real innovation happens when you have a lot of people who are all focused on solving the same kinds of problems. Because I think that when you have that kind of mobilization towards accomplishing something, people start thinking, when people really want something, when people really want to solve something, people really start thinking about different ways about going about that. So I think for us, the first step was, you know, building a company that promoted that kind of culture, that promoted that kind of thinking, that promoted people who were so invested in what they were doing, so relentless in not accepting anything than a good solution. That's, in my opinion, what creates innovation. And it's funny because the first time that we participated, I didn't even know. Actually, it wasn't the first time. We had done it, I think 2019, someone else in our company had done it. But it was interesting because back then, I don't think we were like a truly innovative company. We were doing innovative things, but I don't think we were an innovative company. So in 2023, for instance, I learned about the contest maybe a few weeks before, or actually a few days before the deadline for submitting the proposal. So I submitted the proposal. I had no idea what the pick was. I just went there and said, you know, I'm just going to show my stuff. So I wasn't even doing slides. I was just showing our tech and talking about it like I normally do in demos. I wasn't thinking about the story. I wasn't thinking about the process. I didn't know like the framework very much. And I was actually surprised to see, you know, when I was in that stage, I was able to see that's actually what part, it's like looking at it yourself in a mirror. It was kind of like saying, oh, we are doing crazily innovative things. When I was thinking from this lens, because I don't even think of myself or as our company as an innovative company. I don't think about the title. I think about doing things that matter and solving problems that we consider worthy of our attention, right? So for me, it was kind of like an aha moment. And, oh, okay, so we are solving these really cool things. And, you know, when I looked at how people were presenting, I was like, oh, okay, these people have, in my opinion, a lot better storytelling than I do. They have, you know, they're doing a great job at like really presenting something that's relatable and presentable to the audience. But I just think like we had a lot of raw goodness in what we were showing. And I think that came across last time. With this year, I think same kind of idea. We began thinking about certain ideas about it's. That's where I think it's so interesting. Like, we began thinking about ideas last year about what we wanted to present this year, and it's interesting that none of those ideas went moved forward because we were thinking in the context of the context, and all of that, like all of that fell through, and eventually we were looking again at a problem that we really wanted to solve, and we figured out a very interesting way of solving that problem, which is through this smart dynamic feed. So last year we presented the context-sensitive translate, which is basically our own machine learning methodology that allows the translation editor to learn from the translator in runtime. This year we're presenting the smart dynamic feed, which is basically a way to use large language models to amalgamate information from multiple different sources, whether there's emails, talks from comments from translators, queries, projects that are running late. It's like all of this trove of information, and organize it from most important to least important from a business impact perspective, and also allow users to access that relevant information with just a click. So for us, that was something very powerful because we know, you know, how much the lives of project managers are hard. It's a very hard learning curve. Like, it takes years to become a good project manager. Everything competes with everything. We're like, oh, if we know, if a project manager could know actually what is the most important thing at any given moment, that's really groundbreaking. So, I think for us, the key thing really is about solving problems. And I think if you really want to solve problems, and if you don't run away from the hard problems, the problems, that the annoying problems, the problems that you don't know answers for, that's where the innovation lies, in my opinion. I think what ends up happening is that most people, in my opinion, they end up shying away from those problems because they're definitely the risk reward ratio in those problems isn't interesting, right? It's interesting when you have problems that you know that you're going to solve, that you know that you're going to get something out of. Those are the problems that people focus on, and I think that's cool, that's important, but that doesn't typically promote innovation. Innovation, you need that element of, I don't know if I can solve this, you know, and then you need the surprise, and then it's like, oh, I was able to solve this. Typically, that leads to innovative thought. And I think the other thing for us is, you know, not being tied to, I mean, we love our product, but we're not tied to it. So if we have to change our product completely, we will. So it's like we're tied. Our allegiance is to solving problems in the best possible way. All the rest, we're agnostic. So I think that gives us, you know, a lot of flexibility as far as frameworks of thought. You know, we're not really thinking about monetization. We're not really thinking about, you know, extracting all of the shelf life of a product. We're thinking about doing things that we believe matter and building the best possible products. And I think what's cool is like the contest is just like a consequence. It's not, you know, something that we're actively looking for. I mean, our company is very anarchic. So both Enrique, our chief technology officer, and myself, we're not very ordered, focused people. We like to get things done. And we have other people in the organization who balance this out, who are a lot more focused on process and organization and all of that. But Enrique and I, we're focused on thinking and we're focused on having hard conversations for as much time as we have to. So we don't have, for instance, you know, typically meetings, at least in, obviously there are teams that do that, but we don't have, when our teams meet, my team, the people I talk to, we don't have agendas. We don't have time restrictions for the meetings. Some meetings last 5 minutes, some meetings last 5 hours. You know, we're trying to solve things. Sometimes we'll meet every day in a week for 5 days. Sometimes we won't meet for 2 or 3 weeks. It's, you know, we try when we feel something resonates with all of us, you know, we're like, okay, yeah, that is something that bothers us. That will trigger something. And it's interesting how every product meeting that we have, like, oh, we know we always have asks from our clients, things that they want. And we always have things that we know we have to improve in our platform. And we have, those things that's all, you know, the day-to-day. For me, that's none of that is innovation. For me, the innovation lies into, so like when we get together, we start floating around topics about things that bother us, things that we hear, things that are common denominators, things that we believe are important. And I'm always looking for resonance. So I'm looking for things that I'm feeling that like catches the eye of the other person, the ear, like they're instantly get awakened by. Because I think it's exactly what you said, Eddie, in the sense that if you're not looking for the problem that stirs people up, you're not going to get a cool solution. So I think for me, if I have any talents in this, I think it's about reading people and seeing what it is that they're interested in. Because if I'm floating things that they're not interested in solving, they're going to work, they're going to build something, but it's not going to be cool. So I think, you know, and it's interesting because there are often things that I'd love to solve, but I don't even go there because I know that it doesn't stir them up. And the other thing that I think is really beautiful is tying it all together into a greater concept. So, you know, for instance, I talk a lot about language with our developers and the philosophy of language and meaning. And they love that stuff because that makes their work become, makes it acquire a whole different dimension. They're not just coding, they're reshaping, in their vision, they're reshaping how we work with language. That's a much bigger, deeper, more important and harder mission. So, you know, I think when people feel connected truly to, you know, purpose as opposed to tasks and passion as opposed to duty and dreaming as opposed to just living, I think that's what stirs up, you know, good and innovative thought. And, you know, in my opinion, my main role in the company is to make sure that that vibe stays. And it's very difficult to make that vibe happen. It's very easy to have that vibe go away because it requires a lot of trust. It requires a lot of, you know, it really requires a lot of excellence, because if you don't have excellence in the day-to-day, you can never open up that space for dreaming, because all you're doing is like solving the daily shit. You're not really thinking about, you know, how you can do more interesting things. Yeah, what keeps me up at night is, for instance, where we are as far as tech, right? We already have amazing tech as far as a AI post-editing environment. But for us now, the question is, how do you pay people in a fair way using our tech? There's a lot of like debate, a lot of hate around this. There's a lot of resistance, a lot of, you know, when you're talking about changing people's paychecks, that's a hard conversation. And the methodologies that are out there, whether it's paying people by hour, whether it's paying people by edit distance, whether it's paying people by word count, by pre-analysis, post-analysis, they're not, even though I believe in certain things, for instance, I love the post-editing. I think that's the best methodology out there. It's still, when you get into the actual details of it, for instance, okay, we do post-editing, great. Okay, how much are you going to pay people for reading a sentence? Are you going to pay them 30% of their word rate? Are you going to pay them 50%, 70% of their word rate, 80% of the, what's that time worth compared to, you know, when they start editing? And how much do you pay them for edits? And so all of that structure, there's no real consensus on any of that. And I think, you know, I don't think people realize the level of the level of disruption that we're about to face. And I don't think translators appreciate the fact that they're not up against other translators this time. They're not up against other translators who use machine translation. They're up against companies who want to completely get rid of translation at all, like as a whole. Like it's no longer necessary. That's what a lot of the AI companies are going for. It's like it's simply no longer a human thing. It's a pure large language model thing. So in my opinion, for translators to still be relevant, we're going to have to figure out a way so that, you know, they still have really good income or even better than today, but they're going to be held accountable for a lot greater productivity, a lot greater quality, things that make sense from an economic perspective. And that shift is a very challenging shift. I think I have honestly like a lot more questions than I have answers, but that's what keeps me up at night. Like even as it is right now, you can produce 2 to 3 times the amount of content that you could probably previously do in the same amount of time. And I still believe that like you, language is a human thing. You're going to need human drivers. The human drivers or people in control, they're going to need cars. The car is the software that they're driving, right? So the software is, in my opinion, going to become very, even much more important than it is today as far as governing and controlling this relationship with language. But I think that humans will have this responsibility, yes, like you said, for culturalization, but most importantly for making key architectural decisions around language and versioning and purposing and understanding, bringing it all together. Like, okay, what's this brand? What's the purpose? You know, knowing how to add maybe silly things here and there, like things that are like not necessarily as trivial for a large language model to do. But again, I think that the key thing is that for that to happen, you have to have, like for me, culturalization is the next level of translation. Like if you're spending your bandwidth fixing a fuzzy match, you're not culturalizing. If that's done for you, then that opens up culturalization. So I think this whole notion is, you know, if you get rid of the dirty work, you get into more specialized and more value-added work. The challenge is that from an economic perspective, getting rid from the dirty work also means getting rid of actual work. So it creates just a kind of chicken and the egg problem that I don't know exactly how it's going to play out. I just hope it plays out in a really positive way for everybody. If anything, I want to make sure that we're all having fun. I want to make sure that we're all being very considerate. I want to make sure that we're all thinking about things about from multiple different angles and perspectives. And that's it. I think everything else is going to come from that. No, Eddie, thank you so much for taking the time. Really a pleasure being here with you. And yeah, I want to thank Multilingual for all the work that you guys do in our space. It's super important to carry that message across. And I think you guys really promote the importance and the value of communication across cultures.
And that was our conversation with Gabriel Ferman, CEO of BuraWorks. My name is Eddie Arrieta, CEO of Multilingual Magazine. This is Localization Today. Thanks for listening.